Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Reginald Dwayne Betts says he discovered poetry in solitary confinement. Betts was convicted for using a pistol to carjack a man when he was 16 years old. He was sentenced as an adult and served more than 8 years in an adult prison. After release, Betts earned degrees from Prince George Community College, the University of Maryland, Warren Wilson College, and Yale Law School. He was appointed by President Obama to the Coordinating Council of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and his writing has won numerous awards, including a National Magazine Award in 2018. His new collection of poems is called Felon. He lives in New Haven with his and was in town this week for the Boston Book Festival. Dwayne Betts, thanks for being with us on Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Sorry about that cough at the beginning there.
Oh, no, I cough all the time.
Excellent. So, Dwayne, can you tell us about the moment you discovered poetry?
It might be better put to say the moment poetry discovered me, but I was in solitary confinement for, I guess, maybe the second or third time. And in the hole, you couldn't request books. And so we had sort of a system in which we just passed each other the books that we had. We passed it on. So if somebody shouted, somebody have a book, and they wouldn't name a specific kind of book, they just asked for a book. And whoever was closest to them that would have a book, they would just send it to them. So I called for a book, and I had been there for maybe 3 or 4 months, and I asked for a book, and somebody just slid this anthology, this poetry anthology to me. It was Dudley Randall's Black Poets, and it sort of profoundly changed my life, introduced me to the poetry of Etheridge Knight, Lucille Clifton, Nikki Giovanni, but sort of more importantly, the poems helped me see that in a space of 14 lines or 20 lines or 30 lines, you could communicate what people tried to say in a whole novel, you know, in a whole 30-page essay, 15-page essay, and that I like the idea that in a minute and a half, I could try to tell everybody what mattered for that moment.
So when did you first try it? Do you remember when you wrote your first poem?
Yeah, it would have been the same night. You know, like I read the book, it would have been, I read for Freckleface Gerald, you know, Etheridge Knight had did time in prison, and so part of Becoming Anything is seeing somebody who you could see your own reflection in doing it, and Etheridge Knight has served time in prison. And he had became a poet, and he had became a published poet while incarcerated. And so that same night, I know that I scribbled something.
This new collection of poetry, it's about the emotional trauma of prison. It is greatly varied in the length of the poems and the style of the poems, but there is a strong voice that, you know, I think penetrates all the way through. You talk about the wounds that people who are incarcerated carry with them even when they're out. I'd love to ask you to read one of the poems from the book. It's one of four poems that are called Essay on Reentry. Would you read that for us?
Definitely. Essay on Reentry. At 2 a.m., without enough spirit spilling into my liver to know to keep my mouth shut, my youngest learned of years I spent inside a box. A spell, a kind of incantation I was under. Not whiskey, but history. I robbed a man. This, months before, my son would drop bucket after bucket on opposing players. The entire bedraggled bunch 5 and 6, and he leaping as if every layup erases something. That's how I saw it. My screaming, coaching, sweating presence recompense for the pen. My father ain't never seen me play ball as part of this. My oldest son knew, told of my crimes by a stranger. Tell me we aren't running towards failure is what I want to ask my sons. But it is 2 a.m. The oldest has gone off to dream in the comfort of his room. The youngest, despite him seeming more lucid than me, just reflects cartoons back from his eyes. So when he tells me, Daddy, it's okay, I know what's happening to some scraggling angel lost from his pack, finding a way to fulfill his duty. Lending words to this kid who crawls into my arms, wanting more than stories of my prison. The sleep that he fought, while I held court at a bar with men who knew that when the drinking was done, the drinking wouldn't make the stories we brought home any easier to tell.
Thank you. If I can ask, you have two sons, is that right?
Yes.
How do you talk to your sons about prison?
I think I talk to them. I've learned that I talk to them the way we have to talk to our children about anything. I'm honest. I'm upright. It's complicated. Sometimes I'm sad. I feel like sometimes we aren't able to have this wide range of emotions. We aren't able to tap into what it means to have regrets. And we talk to our children as if we have all of the answers. And sometimes I talk to them and I find myself just admitting that I don't have enough of the answers, let alone all of the answers.
Does it bother you to admit that?
Maybe it did before, but I think I know one of the things that learning to be a parent has been meant for me is learning when whatever I was, whatever I am, is not this body of perfection that my children need. You know, it's just me. And you get that when your child is up at, 2 a.m. and you're frustrated and you just don't know what to do to keep them from crying. And you call in those days because you figured it out. You know, I figured it out then when I didn't have enough, when I hadn't done it before, when I couldn't call on, a family member to come help, when, my wife might have been asleep and she needed to sleep, or when I might have been asleep because I needed to sleep and she had to figure it out. You learn that you are enough, even if that enough isn't everything.
I can't imagine a parent in the world listening to this who doesn't profoundly identify with what you just said. I noted that there are several poems in the book with that same title, Essay on Reentry. Why did you do that, and what were you working towards with four different poems all with that same title?
I think we sort of circumscribe what it means to be incarcerated in such a way that we imagine that the felon is some unique person, that the person who has a criminal conviction is some unique person. And by doing that, it makes it far easier to discriminate against them. But by titling a bunch of poems, Essay on Reentry, I was trying to cover the sort of expansiveness of the experience. I think that people should be able to relate to the poem I just read, even if it isn't prison that they're telling their child about. It could be anything. It could be anything. And you asking your child to give you something that children just aren't required to give us, which is solace, which is like providing the answers that we need from them when sometimes they just need a hug. And then there's other poems that sort of essay on reentry poems that talk about what it means to have reconnected with somebody who the speaker have victimized, right? It means, what does it mean to talk to a person who you hurt and have them remind you of that hurt in a way that is challenging to you? It's poems about the collateral consequences. And so the point is that it's just not one version of coming home. The essay on reentry is trying to remind people that it's multiple iterations of what it means to come home. And they just, sadly, never stop. I'll probably be 50, 60 years old, still contemplating what it means to be free.
Duane, a minute ago you used the word challenging. There are four other poems in the book that you call redacted or redaction poems. And I found them incredibly challenging. They appear on the page. They look like a redacted legal document on the page of the book with big black lines blocking out much of the text. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got the idea of these redaction poems?
I should say you are absolutely correct. They are redacted legal documents.
So those are real legal documents.
Yeah, those are real legal documents.
That was one of the things I was wondering when I read them.
Are you a lawyer?
No, I'm not, but they looked like stuff out of Ferguson, out of the Ferguson report.
Yeah, so you sound like a lawyer right now. which everybody listening will say, oh, man, all I need to do is say that to sound like a lawyer. So what happened was, it's an organization called the Civil Rights Corps. And they filed lawsuits against, like, the city of Montgomery, the city of Ferguson, and the city of Houston. And those lawsuits were because those cities were having practices in which they incarcerated people for their inability to pay bail or to pay small fines. But the thing is, if you want to read one of these civil suits, and the civil suit is at bottom the way a citizen can say, listen, I'm being mistreated by the system, court system, do something to stop me from being mistreated. These lawsuits are 70 pages long. They're filled with all kind of complicated minutiae, things about jurisdiction, all references to other law cases, and nobody is really going to read that 70-page lawsuit. But this, to me, the lawsuit itself is like the one of the sort of symbols of democracy. It is our way to have voice in a system that's supposed to correct error. But what does it mean if nobody could understand the way that the system does that? What does it mean if nobody will read one of these complaints? So what I wanted to do was turn a 70-page complaint into a 4-page poem, a 5-page poem, a 10-page poem. And the redaction, instead of being redacting the things that are supposed to be confidential above our pay grade, I wanted to say, no, I'm redacting what's superfluous. And so when that 70-page poem, that 70-page legal brief, that 70-page complaint becomes a 4-page poem, I'm saying that this is the heart of it. This is what actually matters.
We only have about 2 minutes left, but I really want listeners to hear this. Could you read just the first section of In Alabama for us?
In Alabama versus the city of Montgomery. The plaintiffs, impoverished, jailed by the city, unable to pay traffic tickets, pay or sit in jail. $50 per day. Plaintiffs unable to pay, each sent to jail, told they could work off debts, $25 per day, cleaning the city, scrubbing feces and blood from jail floors.
What's striking is that the story isn't what's behind the black lines. The story is what's left after you use the black lines.
Yeah, it's astonishing that these things were going on when you read the poem. Somebody asked me if I made this up. And these lawsuits, they were all won. You know, the judge in these suits found that the practice were unconstitutional. So these were actually real cases in which the plaintiffs, the people who said that they were harmed, they won. And so when people say, I can't believe that this is happening, what I ask myself is how much of what happens in the criminal justice system happens under our names and we are fundamentally unaware of.
Dwayne, we've got about a minute left. These poems cost a person in reading them. What does it cost you to write your poetry?
Oh, man, I got a minute.
Sorry.
I don't know. I think I know every week I get phone calls from people doing life in prison. So I'm not sure what it cost me, but I know what it cost them to still be serving out their prison sentences. And I hope some of the poetry and some of the advocacy and some of the legal work I do could get somebody free.
Dwayne Betts is an award-winning writer and poet. His new collection is called Felon. Dwayne, I just really appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.